One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai. Kosai.org.
What's most important?
Hello and welcome to episode 129 of What Most People Think. I am recording this ahead of time because I'm hopefully out of the country on holiday. But of course, I would not, you know, especially with the Patreons, miss out a week's show. So I'm either sunning myself abroad or I failed my PCR test and I'm drinking myself to blackout at home. Either way, it's a week off. I got ahead. I don't know what's happened in the news, evidently. So I'm recording this on Sunday morning, a bit hungover. You might be able to hear that in the voice. Went to see AFC Wimbledon yesterday against Sunderland, had a few beers with the lads, went out, had a curry, and I think we all extended ourselves a little bit. You know, I don't think we're Madras people anymore. Let's put it that way. The talk on the WhatsApp group today has been mainly about consequent issues from the curry. I don't know what's happening this week. I don't know if we are, you know, maybe there's been some sort of nuclear destruction, and maybe I'll be getting a suntan off the nuclear winds instead of just blowing, you know, get some gamma rays on my face. But so if I'm not across the topical stuff, that'll be why. Also on that note, the new Patreons. So I'll do a big sweep of those next week. But what I lined up for this week is a great one. It's Russell Kane. What a brilliant, brilliant comic. I mean, when you see him, again, he's one of these sort of tour de force type people, and you've seen him a lot on television and stuff, and he has some excellent social media content too. But I just picked his brain. That's not the phrase. This is hungover Jeff talking. I picked his brain about a number of subjects, and we started off, and we had a laugh and stuff. But then I think he offered some really interesting takes on the kind of censorious and the cancel culture, and the attempts in some quarters at censorship in comedy. And it's very rare that you speak to someone where they make a point and you go, I'd never thought of that, especially in the social media age. But it happened several times with Russell. So we'll be doing a thank you and a fuck you, just a couple of quick ones. The thank you is to Papa Dom's. I had Papa Dom's last night and I just thought, God, I think me and Romesh discussed this, but I'm going to open a Papa Dom restaurant, or maybe a restaurant that just does all the best starters. Like, you know, the Thai and the Chinese starter platters. You just work your way through those, because my God, it's like a child designed food. You know, you get this thing and you break it up and then you get a little spoonful of this. I'm gonna get hungry again. I might do this. What a hungover decision this would be, to go double curry in middle age. This would be unheard of, you know what I mean? I think my intestines might just get up and fucking walk out if I do that. You know, Jeff, you're 45, but so the fuck you is to, I think it's Midland Trains. I got a train from Milton Keynes to Euston on Saturday, and at one point there was a train at 11:15, and it just suddenly disappeared off the departures board, and everyone was scratching their heads and freaking out. And then I spoke to one of the staff there, and he said, oh yeah, what's happened is, they've radioed through and said that the train's really busy and they're standing room only. So we thought we'd just take it off the schedule. But they're standing room, right? So people could make the decision to stand. We just thought, you know, we'd A, make that decision for you, but B, not in any way explain our fucking logic. So the people waiting for the train are now thinking, what is it, some fucking ghost train? Has there been a crash? What has happened? I don't know what's going on with companies. I don't know if I've just hit a certain age, but I'm finding, and email me whatmostpeoplethinkuk@gmail.com. Are you just finding just people being shit at their jobs? I don't know if there's some kind of chronic lag from the pandemic. Do you know what I mean? Like, we're all recovering and we're dealing with some subconscious bullshit that we don't realise. But there's a lot of people just being shit at their job, and in ways like, you know when people make unforced errors, you know, like in tennis where they just had a nice big meaty forehand, it goes straight into the net. I think every company that I'm dealing with at the moment is just slapping forehands into the net. Don't look, if you're going to take God, they did say this would happen in middle age. You know, I'm moaning about public transport. What's it going to be next week, Jeff? You're going to moan about how music doesn't really sound like music anymore. Okay, let's get into the chat with the brilliant Russell Kane. Okay, making his debut on What Most People Think is the brilliant Russell Kane. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Jeff. How you doing?
I'm all right, man. I'm all right. You are... The punters ain't going to be able to see this, but you look fantastic. It's really... I look really? So fucking bedraggled. This is going to be a hard interview for me, having a look at my face and then at yours.
I'm literally in my pyjama t-shirt, out of bed, haven't combed my hair, nothing. This is bedhead. So that is even more of a compliment.
You're making it worse. I mean, you're just like, you know, like one of those women, like, oh my God, I just threw this on. I just threw this face on.
I woke up like this, literally.
How are you out touring at the moment, mate? Are you doing live shows?
I'm just doing little warm-up ones, not previews, because the show is fucking honed and ready to go. Mm. But I just got impatient waiting for the tour to start in March, April. So I said, rather than keep doing these insane, can I gig at your local comedy club for free with no mic and no lights, which I was doing on a regular basis and mugging myself heavily. Yeah. Even though I enjoy the challenge, it's like Rocky One punching frozen meat in the basement because you can't afford a punch bag. I said to my manager, why don't we add a shitload of last minute tiny weenie venues, literally 2 weeks before, and use those to get, because I need to be on a hamster wheel constantly. I've got so much energy. I said, then we're making a bit of money. We're supporting the smaller venues, which don't have the queue around the block for people to play them, like the 1,000 to 3,000 seaters. So it's all good things rolled in. So I'm doing weird shit I've never done before, like Market Drayton I was at last night. 200 seats. But, mate, what a gig. I wish you could get that atmosphere in 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 seats. You just can't. It's not possible.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there is a sweet spot. And I say this as someone who is able to do sort of 400. I think 400, conveniently, is the absolute sweet spot.
500 is lovely. You get that feel of a big rush of laughter, but the intimacy of hitting the back row with your energy. I agree.
You, mate, remember when we could hit the back row with other stuff, eh, Russell? Remember?
Yeah, I still can. I'm biohacking. I'm able to ejaculate in a COVID-safe manner from 2 metres distance.
You look like you've probably discovered some sort of herb or something that could make that possible. Yep. You are. I mean, that's one of the interesting things about you. Obviously, we come from a not wildly dissimilar background, but you've embraced certain aspects of the metropolitan ethos, right, in terms of looking after yourself, right? You look after yourself quite well.
Yes, but at the same time, out of all the people that have come from where I've come from and gone on to earn the money, I've gone and live in a nice gaff. I'm one of the few that all my friends are still my friends from home. My social life is still my family, my mums, my aunties, my cousins. Yes, okay, I might go out for a coffee with a comic. If it's around a project or we're talking, it's not that I'm unfriendly. It's just I've obviously just thought I love my friends where I'm from and I'm sticking with that.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I kind of did the same thing. I went to university, but I didn't go and live there. I commuted. And in comedy, there's literally a handful of people that I've become friends with. And so consequently, you're probably the same as me. I never know the gossip, right?
No, I'm an outside. I did worse than that. I turned my life around to go to university from an unbelievably tiny odds. I had to get an A grade to prove to university I wasn't just a junkie waster, which I got. And I was living with my nan at the time in a single box room of a housing association flat. I didn't have a wardrobe. I had to stick my clothes on the wall using these hooks that you stuck on the wall I got from the co-op. Mm. And I thought, I just don't want to turn into a wanker. But at the same time, I saw all like the video Spring Break and all the carnage and shots in halls. I wanted both. So I went one better than you. I went to the campus that was 20 minutes from my nan's house and lived there. So I was able to pop home to see my nan and all my mate, but also get on it.
Yeah, but always have the option of a boiled bacon sandwich. You want a boiled bacon sandwich, boy?
Oh, yeah. It's toad in the hole. She used to make it in a loaf tin. So, like, you know, like a little loaf tape tin with all cocktail sausages sprinkled through. The toad in the hole would be like that. She'd serve it with gravy and a side order of chips and a sandwich on the side. Mate, that was me set.
And a sandwich.
Is there a thing anymore? Like, you know, when you're enamored off your sandwich, you go one round or two. That's not a thing anymore. No one thinks that someone would want two sandwiches while having a sandwich. And then you just have to, you'd have two, and then you just pass out on their couch.
Bread isn't even a thing anymore, Jeff, if you're middle class.
Just a collection of seeds. I mean, it's interesting that I wanted to get to class. I wanted to get to class, but it feels like we've started here. So let's sort of do that thing that working class people do, where we do working class credentials, right? Where we sort of battle each other to decide who had the shittest life.
Let's do it. Bottom trumps, I call it.
But so we've already had housing association. That's good. But let's look at more sort of material markers, right? Holidays as a kid. Where did you holiday?
Devon.
There you go.
Devon. See? Really. Till I was about 11, and then my dad told me we were going to go on an aeroplane for the first time, and I actually couldn't believe it. And we went to Menorca, and I fucking might as well have been going to space. And I went to Menorca when I was 11, and then when I was 13, and then because of my age, it was just flights were starting to come down in price round about then.
Yeah.
And some of the working class kids at school whose mum and dad would sacrifice anything for their happiness, those fuckers, yeah. They'd gone to Disney and Florida, and the dad basically sold a kidney and shit. My dad was one of the higher earner working class. He's skilled manual labour. He's a lagger, a sheet metal insulation engineer and a lagger. So that's decent money. It's probably fucking 80 grand a year job now.
Yeah.
And so eventually, when I was 16, my dad finally said, gather around, boys, we're going to Florida. And me and my brother were crying with happiness. And while we were crying, he went, but not the shit tourist bit, the north bit where it's quiet beaches.
Yeah.
So we didn't even see Disney.
I have to say, it's only the first marker here. I think you've outperformed me there. Devon, we used to basically go in a straight line from South London down to where the nearest sea was.
Southampton.
It was the Kent coast. You know, it was the Kent coast. No, from South London. It was the Kent coast. So actually, maybe a bit across, but it was a place called Dymchurch, which it sounds like it is. And they had it had Dungeness nuclear power station was part of the view. So I remember. I think that, you know, people that went abroad to Spain, that was kind of like a threshold. But there's also that thing, like you say, your old man earned well, but there was still obviously steeped heavily in working class values, right? But what are those values?
So when I speak to audiences, I say I've lived every tier you can live apart from the very top and the very bottom. So I've never been homeless, and I've never been sort of aristocratic, living in a £20 million house, castle, you know, super elite private jet. I've never been either of those. But my first home for 8 months, I don't remember, obviously, was a mother and baby shelter. So that's about as far down as you can go. So me and my dad would come, would work. They just didn't have a house, basically. There's nothing bad going on. So my dad would have to come and have dinner with my mum, a little bit of takeaway next to her bed and her cot. And my mum was in a shared room for 8 months. We went from that to council flat to council house. The Margaret Thatcher Lord Lover allowed us to buy our own council house. And that's when my dad just... That sort of transformed his pride. I think it had a real effect on me. I know it's not a fashionable thing to say, but it did. And then, so then we lived in a private house on a council estate, and then I moved out private. And then I started again from the next middle class private flat, private house, semi-detached house. Now I'm in a detached, private, decent-sized house, a big one, that people would go, fucking hell, you got that. So I've literally lived at every tier. So I can confidently comment, working class people isn't what people think it is, you know, like scratch cards and all that. We would call those people like the lower working class, like the chavs on the estate. We would look down on like scratch card Christine and her husband who signs on. You work, you graft. It's clues in the name, guys. If my dad's fucking liver was hanging out of his ass, he would have dragged himself on one claw to work in a factory or something. You don't sign on, you don't ponce, you don't bitch in public, you graft, you have a takeaway at the weekend and you do it all over again.
Just going back to what you said about the sort of deregulation of the airline industry, this is something I felt when I first went and booked a flight myself in a travel agent's, right? I just didn't feel like it was something. People talk about imposter syndrome. I didn't think that was something I would be allowed to do. I went in there, I knew that the process was available to me, but at every step I just felt fucking anxious. And I sort of had it in my head that I would need a responsible adult to kind of say, yeah, he's like a GP, like get my local GP along. This is Dr. Baxter. He's treated me for years. He knows that while a lot of my mates are wrong ones, I'm actually quite responsible. So excuse that. Hi, babe. I'm just doing the podcast. Can I give you a call back? All right, babe. All right, love you. Bye, bye.
Is that your best mate, Dave? I'm not a wrong one, and I love you.
That is staying in. To my detriment, but a good joke is a good joke. But did you ever feel that when you first... Did you ever have that hesitancy? Or I guess you'd been on a flight to...
So I like started getting business class flights thrown in for jobs I was doing. Now I must have done that a good few times now. I still cannot get my head around. I'm lying on a flatbed in the air. I do the peasant skip, sending pictures to the boys group, sending pictures to my mum, pictures of the buffet in the departure lounge. Look at this fucking salmon everywhere. It's not worn off. And I said, I remember Lindsay, we've been together 10 years now. I said, it's going to be a shame when this becomes usual to us if I keep doing well. But it hasn't. Every single time we do like the pig nose, you know, when you have like a different boarding lane, my nose goes in the air, I fucking feel the absolute bollocks. Yeah. I feel like I've been given a freebie that I haven't earned, that I'm blessed to have. I don't feel like an imposter. I feel like I'm on a, like I've won something on Ant and Dec's Limitless Win show, and this is the prize and I can't believe it. Like when you get a hamper for free and you're like, all this shit we've been given, it's that feeling.
Yeah, I think it's nice that there's some things that don't get old in life. I mean, one of my current obsessions is, and this started during the lockdown, is I can just have cans of proper Coke in my fridge. And just because when I was young, my mum went for not just the shit brand, but like the needlessly shit brand. I mean, it was just brown water from Quicksand,
yeah,
right?
We had all of that, yeah, brown water. We had all that.
Well, because there was levels, wasn't there? There was kind of like this one I had called Vogue Cola. And then there was kind of Happy Shopper Cola, Roller Cola, going up supermarket own brand, Virgin, and then the Absolute Daddy, which is real Coke. And I just think it's a wonderful thing. Like you say, there's always a part of me that thinks that it'll get boring. But to me, I open that fridge and I look in it, I'm like, we're doing all right.
And that's why it's easier to be happy, I think, if you're working class. I would love to know if there's any stats on working class people that have made money versus middle class people that have made money and depression and happiness. Mm. Because there's a sort of, depending on when you got it, and I got it late, there's a sort of core level of gratitude that you just can't eradicate. You just, unless you're a psychopath or a complete cock, every morning there's a little, if you were to work on it and there was a bit more poncy, you could probably sit there and close your eyes for a minute and go, how fucking lucky am I, and have a banging day. That's going to be a lot harder if your name's Lottie or Ollie.
I mean, it's funny, actually, you mentioned there, like you said, you know, semi-ironically about, God bless you, Margaret Thatcher. I mean, you know, you know what happened to Molly May, mate. If you even show even vague Thatcherite tendencies. What did you think, just going out sideways to that, of what happened to her? Because I kind of felt like, and I'm not the world's greatest feminist, I think that might be an understatement, but I did feel like when women in the public eye say anything that sounds a bit capitalist or even right of centre, they do seem to get set upon worse than men. Do you feel that? And if you do feel that, why is it?
Well, you can see that some of it's misogyny inflected purely because this still we still live in an unequal society, and it's like oh, look at her, woman above her station. She's 22 years old. She doesn't have the right. I mean, there's another story today with her, funnily enough, that she's releasing an autobiography at 22. How dare she? So it's a prejudice against her being female, prejudice against her being young, and prejudice against her being a young, wealthy female. The three things a lot of men in their 40s probably don't like.
Guys, right, that would normally be, this is what a feminist looks like, bloke. But some reason, they do tend to suspend certain kind of rules of engagement when it comes to... Because, do you know what I think, Russell? I think it comes from a sexist presumption. Is i.e., right, first up, the left is the goodies, right? So they think the left equals good. Then they think, well, women are nicer. And so when you combine those two things, they sort of think, well, that's not very virtuous, is it? That's not very kind. Women are under no obligation to be kinder than men.
Absolutely. And in fact, there's an analogous example here. The day we're recording, yesterday it was a big thing about, and the day before, this footballer Zuma that kicked his cat. And quite rightly, everyone in the UK was like, you fucking bellend. You deserve to lose your job. You deserve to get fined. But I slowly watched it turn to be after I put my shit out. I didn't even know the guy was black. I didn't even know he was French. I just thought he was a footballer called Zuma. I know nothing about football. I had to Google the fucker to work out who he was. I fucking love animals and I hate animal cruelty. So I've gone hell for leather just for him, for his act. But I've slowly seen a few racially inflected people enjoying bashing him a bit more because he's black. It's the same thing again. So if a person of colour makes a mistake like that, they tend to get kicked harder than if white bloke makes it. Although what he did was repellent. He's a total C-U-N-T and I'll tell him to his face. But I don't like the way that the vitriol gets inflected. Going back to what Molly said, though, what she said was wrong, in my opinion. Like, I don't want to put any more fire on it. What she said that was offensive, I couldn't give a shit if she was a bloke, if she was 70 or if she was 20. What she said was that if you were only to work more hours in the day, you could solve your poverty. That's what she appeared to imply. And you can just imagine if you've got like some woman in her 30s on risperidone to keep her mental health issues at bay with one kid that's already in care and another kid hanging off her tit and living off frozen food because her wanker boyfriend's inside. It's not just a case of willpower and energy. There's other fucking shit you need to do first. And I think that just for some people, it was a little bit offensive. There was a bit X Factor, stand on the X Factor spot and wait for the magic wand.
Well, I suppose it's always appealed to me, the idea. The reason that I sort of eschew victim narrative is simply because I have to believe that I can change my own situation, right? So even if it's actually true, even if there are barriers in place that prove the barrier, even to someone like me with all my privilege and the daily high five and hall of mirrors that I do just for being born a straight white man, I never understand where thinking in that way is going to get me. That's the problem. All that energy that I expend talking about inequalities, valid though it may be, is time that I could be spending creating stuff, right?
Agreed. Totally agreed. And what you're saying is correct. The mistake she made was, she's right to say that we can all change our situation in some way, small steps at a time. She forgot to leave out the most vital bit, that it's harder for some people and others have a longer journey. I saw a brilliant video of a sports coach at an American school, and he put all the kids, have you seen it? He put all the kids in the line to run the 100 metres. And he went, you're going to go when I fire my gun, but first of all, I want everyone with a single mother to take two steps back. If you're female, take another step back. If you're African American, take another step back. If your dad doesn't work, take another step back. Right, go. And made them race from those points. And he said, yes, you could all run. You can all put in as much energy as you like. No doubt about it. But we have to acknowledge that some people have got to run a little bit harder and a little bit further because they've been put back by their situations or whatever, or prejudice or disability or whatever it might be. That she just, it was clumsy phrasing. And unfortunately, clumsy phrasing in the Daily Mail. It could happen to me and you. It could happen off the back of this chat.
Well, yeah, you know, I suppose that's the issue that I have at the moment with kind of backlashes to things is that the scrutiny and the jeopardy of podcasts, I think, have slightly less jeopardy than tweeting. Tweeting, you could immediately be in trouble, right?
Yeah.
Whereas podcasts, they've at least got to do a bit of effort. They've got to excavate. They've got to pull things out of context. And the tone in which you said something will still be there. But what I found odd was comedians going in hard on her. When if you weren't able to just run your fucking mouth on podcasts, right, without being held accountable, it would be a problem for comedians. Of all people, I just felt that we should look at a 22-year-old influencer and maybe just apply, in the same way that you should apply coefficients for poverty, we should also apply a coefficient that she's famous because she was on Love Island.
She's
right?
22. But the correct response was, I'm going to say this, my response. I didn't do an ad hominem attack. I didn't go for her. I didn't call her out. I didn't do one of my rants. On the next daytime topical show where it was debated, we took the issue from it, like we're doing now. We're saying, well, what is it? Can we all change our way equally with energy? Yes. But some people are starting further. We're having an adult discussion about it. We're not slagging her off. So when people come up with ideas that you don't agree with, I wish it just provoked heated exchange of ideas rather than a heated shooting down of an individual.
Yeah, absolutely,
She's not been racist. She's not been prejudiced. She's not hurt anyone. She's spoken from the heart about what she believes. Okay, Molly, great. Disagree with you. Let's have an interesting conversation about inequality off the back of it.
All right. Hope you're enjoying the chat with Russell there. As I say, new patrons, I will pick that up next week. But I just want to remind people while I'm away, keep buying those tour tickets. There's some dates in particular that I want to shout out that I don't think that I've mentioned very often. We're going to Winchester, 27th of February. We're going to be in Newcastle on Saturday, the 5th of March. Wellingborough Theatre, the Castle Theatre, on Wednesday, the 9th of March. We're going to be in Taunton on Friday, the 11th of March. And then the following day, keeping it down there in the West Country, I'm going to be at Plymouth, the Quad Theatre, on Saturday, the 12th of March. Belfast, the 18th of March, the day after St. Patrick's Day. I have no idea why I thought that was that's an interesting booking, isn't it? I'm going to be at the Melrose Corn Exchange. It's in Scotland. That's all I know about it. It's Melrose. It's got a corn exchange. Once upon a time, they exchanged corns. And now I'm going to be exchanging jokes in return for money. And if you haven't bought your tour tickets yet, the new dates are selling well. Glasgow, Saffron Walden in particular, that is going to sell out. Huntingdon on the 14th of March. Another one in Maidenhead. And also I'm in Spalding up there in the Midlands. So, yeah, get on it. All right, let's go back to my non-hungover sounding self of several days previously when I was still a fresh-faced young man who hadn't added another hangover to his charge sheet. And let's get back to the chat with Russell Kane. So I've decided to introduce a new format point to the podcast.
Oh, yeah. Go on.
I've got a son. He's called Seb. It's Sebastian for the mortgage application, Seb for the stag do. You know it is. And he gets to ask my guest a question. And I thought he was going to say something really surreal, but he just said, "Why did you become a comedian, Russell Kane? Why?" I mean, it's a big question in some ways, isn't it? Why?
I get really jealous when I see some of our colleagues from both sides of the pond, British, and go, "I used to be a kid and I used to stand up on stage and make everyone laugh and I always knew." Mm. Or the first time I saw Billy Connolly on our TV, I just thought, "Man, I'm going to do that one day." And I've always loved stand-up. I used to watch American stand-up. I am yet to find a comedian with less interest or knowledge of stand-up than me before I did it. I'm talking zero, and I was 28 when I did my first gig. So I've gone all the way through the childhood we've just discussed. Now, my dad was an older dad when he had me, meaning his humour was always going to be right-wing anyway. But we're talking Roy Chubby Brown, Bernard Manning for stand-up, and Laurel and Hardy and shit like that for belly laugh comedy that I could join in with that I found funny too. So I just thought, I didn't have a problem with it because I wasn't sophisticated enough or educated enough to know. I just thought that, you know, but I'm at the end of the day, I'm at a jungle rave. My friends are mixed, black, white, fucking everything going on. It doesn't make me laugh, that Bernard Manning humour, because I didn't get it. Because it wasn't about my world. So I'd got all the way to 1920 without any conception that there was another type of stand-up, which had started in the 80s, called alternative comedy. I knew nothing about it. Yes, of course, I'd seen The Young Ones, but that's hardly man or woman with a microphone. That's a funny series. And then I went to the one university down the road near my nan, no stand-up night, got all the way through those 3 years. Everyone's always told me, "You're hilarious," but every group's got a hilarious mate. What's fucking special about that? It wasn't until I was doing middle-class job in an ad agency that they started to go, "Please try stand-up. You would fucking smash Edinburgh, all these..." So I Googled Edinburgh. I thought it was ballet and opera and stuff. I thought that's what the Edinburgh Festival was. Googled comedy, started to realise, oh, right, Eddie Murphy, Robin Williams, their stand-up started. And literally, in a space of 1 week, went from that Google search to how to do comedy for free in London, called the first link, Comedy Cafe, called it, booked a slot in the August. Then I had 1 month, and in that month, I saw stand-up comedy live for the first time twice. I went to Jonglers, and I went to the Comedy Store, and then I went and did it. It was that mechanical, and it was done more like a dare, like someone saying, "You'd be great at bungee jump, just do it once." It was that sort of vibe. It wasn't that, "I'm going to try this, man."
It's interesting. We come from it from a similar point of view. I knew the big hitters like, you know, Eddie Murphy, Dave Allen, who my mum loved and stuff, but I didn't know any of that.
Thought Eddie Murphy was an actor.
And all I thought was I had this desire to be on stage and be heard and to have my belly tickled, essentially. And I remember like doing my first gigs and stuff, and you might have had this too, was there is this, the students of it. And I remember somebody saying to me, "You've never watched Bill Hicks." Just the way he said it, I still remember, you know, like you don't remember these gigs from years ago, done thousands of gigs.
Yeah.
But he's on the South Coast and he just said, "You've never watched Bill Hicks." And it's those little...
I'd never heard that name in my entire fucking life, Bill Hicks, ever. I went all the way through uni with a mixture of middle class and working. I'd never heard that name in my entire fucking life until people started reverently saying it backstage at the Comedy Store and stuff. And then I had to pretend to join in. So, and then go home and go, like I do with what I call white people's music, which I've never listened to. So people will go, you know, like Oasis and Blur. And I go, I need to catch up, because all the comedians I wanted to like me, they were all into like indie music and shit like that, and Foo Fighters and things I'd never heard of. And I just want to listen to fucked up jungle or techno while I'm lying on the floor like Stephen Hawking in Ibiza. I had no what I call mainstream knowledge of things like that. So I've had to learn them virtually in my 30s.
But you are, like, I suppose you are a bit of a Renaissance man in a way. It's been said about you before, is that you've come to certain cultural things later in life. Is there that thing, you know, like with Russell Brand, when he says long words, he has to say it in a certain way, which sort of indicates that maybe he's trying to cover off that he doesn't feel comfortable saying it. When you wear your sort of intelligence on your sleeve, do you feel like you have to package it or give it a flourish?
Yes.
Is there that imposter thing?
In the opposite way, though. All due respect to Russell Brand, if I feel a complex or profound thought coming, I'm like, what is the most simple or base way that I could phrase it that cleverly showcases the complexity in really, like, boom, bold words, something a bit catchy for the image? I would never, if I walked into a room of noisy people, think the correct word here is obstreperous, which it is. I just wouldn't use it. There's no need to use it. I know all of those words, and I'm embarrassed about how I learned them. But I, unlike some other working class Renaissance motor mouth people, and there's plenty of us, I wanted it verified. I wanted to go to university. I wanted to get a first. I needed to know it was real from people that were at the top of the tree. And there was no fucking way I was leaving that place without a first. No way. I've gone my whole life with fuck all, no recognition, shit GCSEs. It was like someone hit me with that one punch when I was 18 with my failed A-levels, and I just looked at the blood and I was like, never, ever, ever again. And then bang, it was A grades and firsts all the way through. Oh, every module bar one on my degree, I got a first. The word thing's interesting because I don't know anyone else that did this. So what happened was, I got this punch, yeah? And this punch took the form. I was at a rave. It was a legal one. A legal one in Vauxhall. I was off my tits, and this girl came through the smoke, about 2 inches taller than me, fucking beautiful girl. One of those girls just gets scouted. She hand me her phone number. I was like, what the fuck? She's just taking a shine to me. We start dating, and she's, by now I've failed at my A-levels and I'm just working a watch shop. I'm just generic, fucked up over the park, working class boy sitting around with the glueys by the dog shit bin like everyone else on my estate. I'd just become what I was destined to become. But the thing with this punch that hit me in the face was this. When I was going back to hers and waking up, she was in halls in this same university we've just been speaking about. And I was waking up and seeing all these people, the other side of the gate, as it were, the metaphorical gate, sat on the lawn, having some cider, clutching books from the bookshop. And the thing that wound me up the most, waking up at 11 a.m. and trotting across to... I was 18 at this point, like an old man hunched on the tube, broken, going to sell watches to rich people. I could feel my belly was... I'd lost my fitness. I was fucked at 19. I'd given up. And I was like, how dare the system be gamed so that I fulfill a role that was set for me at birth? Not me, mate, fucking Daniel, son. And that's when I was like, I'm going to be there next year and I'm going to get better grades than everyone with a better education than me. But so that started to happen, but we had a problem. I was doing English literature, and the problem if you're doing English literature is I physically didn't have the language. I've got the basic vocabulary that everyone has, but to start learning about Jane Austen and Charles Dickens, which I was easily able to do, you still need to know what the word obstreperous means. What does the word impudent mean? I didn't know. I'd never heard it. So what I did was I got this system going. I did all the texts I was supposed to do, but I was getting up an hour earlier and pre-reading other books. And every time I encountered a word I've never seen in my life, remember, this is just before fast internet, I would get an index card and write impudent down. I learned the diacritic markings, because at the end of the day, that could be impudent, impudent. I didn't have a clue. Taught myself the little ticks and crosses. And I wrote down all the cognates as well, impudently, impudent.
Russell, why am I getting 80s training montage scene in my mind here? I mean, you mentioned Rocky
I built up 1,000 cards, Jeb, 1,000 cards, and I did them on the toilet and stuff like that. And I only stopped using the card when the thought naturally occurred to me with the word. Then I threw the card away.
This is, I mean, it's incredible. And one thing I am thinking is that it's one of those things that if you got a girl back and she discovered it, she wouldn't think that it meant you're a murderous psycho, but it wouldn't mean that you weren't either. No. For some reason, there's no reason that should be bad, but a guy with like an excessively kind of a grid referenced thing of words.
I had to manually upload my vocabulary, like learning French or Italian for the first time. I had to learn English properly, how to speak it, how to conjugate it, how to use whom and whom and them and there.
You, I mean, talking about you on stage, I mean, I say, you know, you're one of the best stand-ups I've ever seen live. You're real, like,
oh, mate.
You are a tour, you know, you're tour de force. You bring so much on stage. I feel at this point in time, there's a lot of talk about the negatives in comedy, what you can, can't say, and stuff like that. If we should talk about the positives. I reckon this is the best time I can remember to be on stage, and I don't know why that is. Maybe it's the audience need a laugh more than ever. I don't know if they definitely want to offensive gear or they want right-wing gear or any of that stuff. What I think that they do want is honesty more than ever before. I was just interested as to whether you're feeling something different in the air since we've come back after the lockdowns in terms of stand-up. Like I say, not it has to be edgy, but a different appetite from the audience.
Definitely. I mean, I say this every tour, what a bell end, but it's definitely the favourite show I've ever toured. But it's certainly the first one that's ever won something I never thought I would win, which is when The Guardian do the top comedy show of the year. Now, The Guardian, I read The Guardian. I love The Guardian to read it. I pair it with The Sun, obviously, just to balance it out. And but it's, you know, someone like me who looks like me from my back is never going to be the number one, win The Guardian Show of the Year award. I did 2020. I still cannot get my fucking head around that. So, and I think what it is, it's the first time, the show's not topical, Nish Kumar topical, but it's about 2020 and what we went through.
Yeah.
And it's just so electric and alive to bite down onto a live situation mixed with people that are, again, last night, 80% of the audience never been shoulder to shoulder and maskless since 2020 March. That's incredible. And they're sat there like we're doing something wrong, like we've broken out of a prison.
Yeah.
Mixed with laughter while you're fleeing the prison. That's the difference in the atmosphere. And to for me, who'd lucky enough to have a show that's talking about it, I've had tears at the end twice this week. So I sort of dropped the mic, not Gadsby level. It's only for like 30 seconds at the end. I just do a little magical bit at the end. People are crying and standing up. I mean, I've never had that, not since my 2010 one about my old man pegging it. So it's, I would agree with you. There's magic in there, and it won't last. That's what I hate. You can feel it fading day by day.
I agree. I think one thing is, if you talk about like observational comedy, often gets reduced to sort of garlic bread. But actually, it quite simply is taking what's happening. This isn't, like you say, it's not topical. It's very rare that you have something that we've pretty much all been through, all done. So there's, you know, we're all men and women. That subject does well. We're all from the north or the south.
Oh, fucking hell, Jeff. Do you want to get cancelled? Do you want to think about the sentence you just used? We're all men and women. That was the end of Jeff Norcott's career.
No, I'm not expecting you to come in on this. I am willing to be the edgelord that suggests that there are, in principle, men and women. And I know, I'm shocking, mate. It's amazing I get booked. Amazing that running against the tide of public opinion. But I think that there is something in a shared experience, because you can sort of talk about getting your booster jab, and you know that most people got their booster jab, and if they didn't, they have a strong reason why they didn't. And I just, what I sort of said in last week's podcast, I said, come and see this, because I genuinely know the next one probably won't be as good. I mean, that's awful to say, but I genuinely, and probably people are going to play this back when I'm plugging the next one now. While we're on the subject, sorry, of plugging, obviously this tour is going to rip it and stuff like that. Obviously, loads of them sold out and stuff like that. Are there any ones, we've all got those places that we don't sell as well, we like. Where's your place? Where's your place where you're like, what the fuck have I done?
They are taking, I've never had a tour sell like this, which is incredible, because I'm doing a fair bit on Channel 4 during the day, but on paper, because of lockdown and all that, I've probably done less comedy telly than I've ever done in a year. I mean, that goes to show how fucking business model has changed. That said, Carlisle Sands Centre.
Carlisle, always a tricky one. Same, mate, same. I've got a gig in Carlisle, and I bet you'll have the same as me, where people give you shit when you announce your last tour. You never come to Carlisle, and then it turns out that the people that asked for that were the only two fuckers in Carlisle. that were really up for
it's because no one lives around it. No one lives around Carlisle. You've got to be in Carlisle to go.
I'm not going to talk about, you know, the recent controversies too much, but we do seem to be quite well rehearsed now into our responses. So we had the Jimmy Carr controversy and people sort of... One thing I do find, Russell, is that I find a lot of comics will sort of say in public that kind of, you know, cancel culture doesn't exist and then secretly confide in you in the green room that are fucking terrified. Where do you kind of sort of stand on the environment that we work in these days?
Well, I don't believe it's more difficult to be a comedian now, speech-wise, than it was. I think it was a hell of a lot fucking harder to be a stand-up. If we were sat with Bernard Manning, Jimmy Jones, Victoria Wood, about to do a gala in the 1970s, the list of shit you couldn't say was much, much longer. I mean, anything to do with sex, any swear. I mean,
the Queen.
Not being able to use a swear word to emphasise your... So people have got to remember that, yes, there's different things you can be cancelled for now that annoy Gary, Dave, Jeff and Russell a little bit more, but they just replaced the other things that were much more difficult in the past. I was speaking to the audience last night. I said, it's really funny. So I did my first tour in 2009, and it's obviously I fucking come on stage 100 miles an hour, fucking spunk shit, like all this all over the place, as well as mixed with the intelligent stuff. And the people that would walk out, always silver hair. I'm sorry, it's not you, young man. You're very nice on TV, but my wife, it's a little bit coarse. We're going to have to leave.
Bit blue.
Now, all the people with silver hair, they were, you know, they're the people who first watched alternative comedy. They're people in the 70s and 80s are crying, laughing, the ruder it gets. The people walking out, people aged 15 to 21 who are triggered or hurt, or, oh my God, it's so confrontational. So it's not that it's more difficult. It's just public speech where you're trying to be provocative has always been difficult.
Yeah.
Go back to the time of fucking the Bible and publish a pamphlet. See how far you get. You know, get out your time machine in Henry VIII's England and publish a satirical leaflet. See if you still get your genitals at the end of the day. It's just difficult in a different way. What's happened when you're on stage and you find yourself cancelled is you have made a mistake. You've misjudged it. You've fluffed the decision. The world isn't against you. If I go out and accidentally use the N-word because I'm not thinking, I'm like, oh my God, this world we live in. It's like I've made a theatrical mistake. I've taken my eye off the steering wheel and I've fucking bumped into someone.
I think you made loads of really good points there. And it's very rare to say this these days, is you made a point that I haven't heard anyone make and really given any thought to, is about the sort of shifting paradigms of what's offensive. You know, if you was to just insult the Queen in 1970, that would have been a massive national outcry.
Do you remember Julian Clary? Sorry I'm late, I was fisting Norman Lamont. Fucking finished him for a decade. A fisting joke. These days, you know, you'd see it at 7 p.m, welcome to Naked Attraction, where I'm going to fist Prince Andrew. We'd go, oh, that's so brave. No one would fucking think anything of it.
No, and if you remember not so long ago, you know, 2008-09, Saxgate, you know, essentially an off-colour remark.
Exactly.
On a podcast, and that did come from the right. So I think you're right in that it does move around. But, you know, if you get into the realms of a comic who goes on stage and just says, like you say, an unacceptable word, doesn't have to be, one of those words that you're not allowed to say anymore. That's my question is, what should the consequences be for that? I think there should be that people have a pop ear and you apologise. Maybe the difference now is there's a hardcore that seem to think that they should agitate for an outcome. Like, you know, the removal and sanctions that perhaps... Maybe that is the difference, is that how active people are in trying to push for the greatest consequences.
But that happens across the board, though. I mean, heaven forbid that sort of Nish Kumar or Darren Harriet or someone like that makes a joke where there is someone with Jewish ethnicity, of which I have a bit at the core. Do you think everyone would go easy on them?
No.
They'd be fucked. So it's across the board. It's not like this big gang of lefties waiting for white people to say the wrong thing. It's across the board sensitivities have changed. I'm a big fan of... which is ironic given I do Evil Genius podcast, but that is to take the piss out of lack of context. If you're talking about Jimmy Carr, which we are euphemistically, you've got a massive track record of service mixed with a joke that's gone through a producer and an editor. They're things to take into account. So this is why he probably will get away with an apology and then back on stage next week. He will. Massive length of service. We trust him. Mm. It's gone through an editor. It's a TV production. If someone who's a bit newer has a drink before they go on the gig and comes out, I'll use a comedy thing so I don't annoy anyone, and starts going about, he hates everyone from Liechtenstein, fucking Liechtensteinian scum, and loses it, it's different. It's not like, well, we should have a process and an outcome for both. No, one's a silly cunt that deserves everything he gets. The other's got a massive track record that's maybe misjudged a ninja move, and it's a more subtle evaluation process.
People from Liechtenstein are cunts, though.
Yeah, I know. There's two types of comic, yeah? There's two, broadly speaking. There's someone like me, spineless twat, that just wants to be liked. I will do anything to get 1,000% of the people laughing and liking me. If that means dropping jokes, changing how I'm speaking, you better fucking believe it's going to happen. Then there's type B, your Stuart Lees, Frankie Boyles, Hannah Gadsby, Catherine Ryan to a certain extent, and Jimmy Carr. They're going to come out, and if you don't like it, fuck you. And we like them because of that as well. Bill Hicks would have been another one. They're the ones who people are remembering 100 years, not me, the music hall jester. So that they will come out and they've got a line. So the rule I follow, and I don't expect anyone else to follow it, is if everyone's put their hand in their pocket for 20 to 50 quid to come and see me, and someone leaves and they're upset and they're crying in their car, who the fuck am I to have done that to that person who's put 50 quid in their pocket to come and see me? But that's the working class effort coming through. That's the only reason I would never punch down, not because of some lefty guardianista moral thing. It's like, if there's a couple from Nigeria in the front row and I do some horrible joke making fun of British Nigerians and they're crying in their car, I feel like I've failed at my job, which was for them, who spent their money. Maybe they booked a hotel and had a bit of dinner. It's my job to make them laugh, not to be so edgy someone leaves crying. That's just the way I view stand-up, and not everyone else does.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things, is it does make me laugh. You know, people often say about me, oh, he thinks he's edgy. I'm so distraught if I've genuinely fucked someone off. Do you know what I mean? I'm not built sometimes. I do like to get out on the front foot, but I'm equally not built to deal with the reaction sometimes, which means what I think, Russell, is I think that, right, if I'm going to get in trouble for a joke, I'm going to want to stand by this. You know what I mean? Like, so I don't want to... My worst thing would be to get in trouble for a shit joke. I think that would hurt. That would hurt, because you go, oh, I've got to pull this energy into defending myself when I know deep down it's not a good joke, you know? So maybe the answer is in, you know, partly in what you're saying about is there another option, but partly just about quality threshold.
Well, I've got in trouble for shit jokes, but it's always I've punched up disrespectfully and the joke's not good enough. So I did, it was me and David Baddiel together actually, made a joke about the Queen. I can't remember what it said. Something about a royal flush. I think the punchline was a royal flush and she was having a shit or something like that. And it went out, unfortunately, on Radio 4. And unfortunately, it went out when the Queen was celebrating something or other. And that was it. I was in the papers. Hey, you fucking scumbag. But because I'm just a peasant going up to power, yes, I got it wrong. This was disrespectful and I messed up. You can get away with it. If I'm going on to people that have no voice and no power, it's just not my sense of humour. It's just a taste thing. It's not a lefty thing. Mm. I just don't see where I can't think of something clever enough. The only time I make an exception is if it's people from my own culture that I grew up with. Then I'm more than happy to have a fun at Stacey being spunked on in the alleyway doing a scratch card, feeding a Finder's crispy pancake, because I feel like, well, that's my first language. I'm well within my rights to dissect where I'm from.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm half Chav, you know.
I always say my first language is Chav.
Listen, Russell, man, it's been really great to talk. I know that obviously the tour is selling well, but I would urge people to get online. If they can get any of the tickets left, then do so.
Yes, please.
Is there stuff in terms of social media? Obviously, you do your Canians and stuff like that. People should check you out. Facebook is a place to go, right?
The best place to go if you want tickets, and I'm going to be adding some like properly monster size rooms, so I will need some help with that. That'll be russellcane.co.uk. If you go there, all the gig lists are there. Sign up to the mailing list and you'll get priority, so you don't get the shitty seats. You can get down in the stalls. If you're a fan of the type of subjects that Jeff and I have been talking about, you know, should people be cancelled or kept, please listen to BBC Radio 4's Evil Genius, where I make fun of the very idea of it, and at the end of the show, the panel have to cancel or keep anyone from fucking Gandhi to Amy Winehouse. It's very uncomfortable for cosy, hummus-covered liberals who come on the show to have to do that vote, so please listen to that.
Well, no, I did the show, and one of the, we were talking about Karl Marx, and it was funny because at the end, I think that because most of the other comics were quite left-wing, they decided that he was actually a genius. He was fine. And I was left with the controversial decision that maybe he wasn't the greatest bloke on earth. But yeah, it's an absolutely brilliant show, which I would definitely direct people towards.
That and Man Baggage, which is where I get blokes together to talk about the things women wished men would talk about. And weirdly, we have a 50-50 listenership. It started out as a kind of sort of man brain, men's issues. That was the vision. It's not that. It's like a manual that women can open and look inside and see what men are thinking. So it's got a massive, I get lots of letters from support from guys that are struggling, like really deep shit. I don't know why they're telling me this stuff, but we use humour to attack those things. So it's very funny, but always deep. So well, check out Man Baggage.
Well, listen, we've only scratched the surface of stuff that we could discuss here, and always interested in the sort of male psyche. So I'd love you to come back at some point and talk about that. But for now, I'm going to leave you in your new home, and thank you very much for being on the show, Russell Kane. So that was the chat with the fantastic Russell Kane there. I hope you enjoyed that. There was some real, I think, real wisdom in there. Really interesting stuff about class and where he's coming from. He's a sharp-minded individual and a brilliant live act. So do go and check him out if you can get tour tickets. We just have one letter. There's one letter I do want to do before I sign out and, you know, get me. Do you remember those things back from the 80s that people used to sit in deck chairs and wear the four, like then the hanky on top of the head turned around at the four corners? Well, before I get whatever that was and email in, if you know what that was called, we just got one letter that I want to do. Okay, this is from Chaz. I don't know what was found the name Chaz, funny. It's from Chaz in Dagenham. And Chaz says, "Dear Jeff, my wife was recently talking about getting a boob job. At first, I was dead against it. And I said to her that I loved her boobs just as they are and that they'd seen a lot of action." What an incredible thing to say. They've seen a lot of action, babe. Those two, they're veterans of many campaigns. Look at that, you know. They've lived to tell the story, got the scars that tell the tale. She seemed to like that. Well, I mean, look, you've got away with one there. You've got away with one there. They've seen a lot of action. What an incredible thing to say. She's now gone off the idea of getting a boob job. But meanwhile, I've started thinking maybe they could do with a refurb. Oh, you, Chaz, you're such a way with words, Chaz. Yeah, you know what, babe? I'm thinking about your tits. And they could do with a re-upholstering. Do you know what I mean? Yeah, I suppose this is a conversation a lot of blokes have at a certain age where their wives have, you know, they've sacrificed some of their perkiness through child rearing and all sorts of other stuff. And then they sort of talk about it. And then blokes initially, I think, will all go down the same road, which is going, no, but because they think money, you know. And then they sort of think about it. And they go, well, you could get these, babe. You know, start coming to them with suggestions. And then the thing is the bloke is always going to, like, think that they should go bigger. You go, well, babe, you're going to get it done. Do you know what I mean? It's like, you might as well. You don't want to be going twice in a couple of years, do you? You know, you don't want to regret going too small. So I would say that given the, you know, the fact that you said something, which was in essence quite sweet to her, that you like them as they are, I would say don't go back on that. I would say don't go back on that. And if you do it, just do it in that pathetic way that blokes do, is where you try and come up with some argument. You know, it's about her self-esteem. You know, you go, girl. Go, you know, do that thing where they click their fingers. But definitely don't say, yeah, no, I've had a think, babe. And, yeah, as much as I do love you exactly as you are, you know, I'd love you even more with a set of double Ds. So on that bombshell, that is it for what most people think this week. We will be back next week. I will hopefully have been away and come back refreshed. Or I'll have just sat in my house and just watch Star Wars for a week. But either way, we will be back with another show. Don't.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.